When a massive building suddenly collapses, the immediate human instinct is to just look right at the rubble.
Right, yeah.
We stare at the dust, the shattered concrete, and we just ask what hit it.
Yeah, we assume some massive external force, right? Like an earthquake or maybe a sinkhole.
Exactly. Or an explosion. We just want to believe that something huge must be responsible for that kind of catastrophic failure.
It's comforting, honestly. We
Right.
crave a visible event to explain the disaster. It's just easier to think that buildings only fall down when something actually knocks them down.
But structural engineers look at this completely differently. They ignore the sky entirely and they look straight at the rebar. They're searching for that microscopic rust that's been, quietly eating away at the foundation in the dark for years.
Just millimeter by millimeter.
Exactly. To the engineer, the building didn't actually collapse on a random Tuesday. It collapsed, like you said, a millimeter at a time over a decade. And today, we are doing that exact same kind of forensic engineering on the American criminal justice system.
I love that analogy. It's perfect for this.
Welcome to this custom deep dive, a dine specifically for you. Today, we are unpacking this genuinely fascinating legal analysis by Eric Sanders. He's a former NYPD officer who actually became a civil rights attorney.
Which is a pretty unique perspective to have.
Oh, totally. And our mission today is to completely rewire how you view police texting scandals. Because when a private group chat full of, offensive memes leaks to the press, the public universally treats it as like a PR nightmare.
Yeah, or maybe a localized human resources issue, like a few bad apples kind of thing.
Right. But we're going to explore why that view just fundamentally misunderstands the actual machinery of the law.
And just to set the stage for you, we are approaching this through a purely mechanical lens today, setting aside the really intense political debates that usually surround policing. Our goal today is to just objectively trace the legal arguments and historical facts in Sanders' analysis.
We're not taking sides here.
No, not at all. We just want to see the gears turning in the background of the justice system. We're exploring the structural impact of these communications on the law itself without taking any political side. We're literally just looking at the architecture.
Because the real aha moment here is shifting your perspective from morality to mechanics. We're going to map out exactly how a private group chat can trigger the collapse of hundreds of criminal convictions
Yeah.
and expose an entire police department to federal intervention.
It's staggering when you look at the scale of it, because the temptation in the media is always to blame the technology, right?
Well, 100%.
The narrative assumes that encrypted apps, vanishing messages, smartphones, that all of this created this new toxic environment.
Right, like if you just ban the app, you cure the culture.
Exactly. But the source material just completely dismantles that assumption by looking at the lineage of the problem.
Yeah, it goes way back.
It really does. To understand how these scandals destroy court cases today, you have to look at the historical precedent. The tech didn't create the problem, it simply updated the delivery system for something deeply entrenched.
Which takes us back over 30 years, like back to the Rodney King era in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
After that incident, the Christopher Commission was formed to investigate the LAPD. And I mean, they didn't have smartphones to look at back then.
No, definitely not.
So they reviewed messages sent on mobile digital terminals.
Yeah.
The MDTs bolted right into the patrol cars between 1989 and 1991.
Those primitive glowing green screens.
Yes. And what the commission found in those digital logs wasn't just a stray vulgarity here or there. It was a fully formed written culture.
Right, on the official channels.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Patrol officers were using official department-issue technology while on duty to trade racist references, joke about violence, and openly discuss violating constitutional limits.
And the analysis actually quotes one specific chilling MDT message where an officer typed, "I'm not happy until I violated somebody's civil rights and then put them in jail."
Oh, wow. I mean, that just eliminates any plausible deniability. You can't read that and claim, oh, it's just a misunderstood joke.
No, you really can't. It reveals an institutional disease. The rules on paper dictated that civil rights were paramount, but the internal permission structure of the department told officers something else entirely.
Right.
The officers trusted their audience, their fellow officers on the MDT network, way more than they feared the rules. And that gap between the written policy and the actual institutional expectation, that's where the foundation starts to rust.
That's the rebar.
Yeah.
It feels a bit like blaming a smartphone for leaked group chat. It's like blaming a megaphone because you don't like what someone is shouting into it.
That's a great way to put it.
The phone didn't write the message. The technology just removed the friction. It allowed this second culture to scale up effortlessly and quietly.
And the fact that these communications are written down is the exact mechanism that makes them so legally volatile today.
Because it's a record.
Right. If an officer makes a disturbing comment in a locker room, the aftermath is murky. They can claim their tone was sarcastic or that they were just misheard.
He said, she said.
Exactly. But a digital group chat preserves the entire environment. It captures the attitude, the emojis, the subsequent comments. It documents whether the audience laughed, whether a supervisor chimed in, or if everyone just, you know, accepted it as normal.
It takes a hidden, ephemeral culture and turns it into hard evidence.
Hard, undeniable evidence.
Which brings us to the most persistent defense that surfaces every single time one of these chats is exposed. The officers involved almost universally claim it was just dark humor.
Yes. The dark humor defense.
And I actually want to push back on this for a second because I think the instinct for a lot of people listening might be to be somewhat sympathetic to that defense.
Yeah.
Because police officers work in highly traumatic, chaotic environments. They are exposed to violence and the absolute worst days of people's lives on a daily basis.
Yeah, the stress is unimaginable for most of us.
Right. And most professions dealing with trauma develop gallows humor as a psychological survival mechanism. Think about ER doctors or firefighters.
Well, the author absolutely acknowledges that argument. And it's an argument used by departments everywhere, from New Jersey all the way to West Yorkshire and England.
But
the analysis cites specific psychological research to dismantle it. There's a study by Dionigi, Dordoni, and Vagnoli. They research how humor functions in high-stress environments, and they draw a very hard line between socially adaptive, benevolent humor and corrosive, dark humor.
So the law is actually looking at the psychological function of the joke.
Yes. So benevolent humor, even if it's a bit grim, genuinely helps regulate stress and build camaraderie without degrading others.
Okay, that makes sense.
But coping with trauma does not mechanically require racism. It does not require homophobia or marking victims of sexual assault or fantasizing about unprovoked violence.
Right.
The research associates those specific expressions of deep cynicism and sarcasm not with healthy coping, but with emotional distress and hostility.
And more crucially, when that hostility is shared in a group setting, it establishes a baseline. It signals to younger officers what the group has decided is acceptable.
It dictates the moral weather of the unit.
Yeah, exactly.
And we have to contrast this with a standard workplace. Because if a cruel, discriminatory joke circulates in a corporate office, the fallout is a hostile work environment. It's an HR crisis.
Maybe a civil lawsuit.
Right. But a police department is wielding state power. When armed officers create off-the-books chats to share this corrosive humor, they're constructing what Sanders calls a shadow channel of state action.
A shadow channel?
Yeah. They use these spaces to discuss suspects, complain about specific neighborhoods, coordinate operations completely outside of public records laws, retention rules, and official supervision.
And once a unit normalizes contempt for certain groups or constitutional rights within that shadow channel, it is guaranteed to bleed into how they enforce the law on the street.
Without a doubt. And this is the exact inflection point where a bad group chat transforms into a legal contagion. It poisons the judicial process from the inside out.
Okay, let's get into the mechanics of that poisoning.
Okay.
Because for a lot of people, I think there's a disconnect between digital behavior and courtroom outcomes.
Right. It doesn't seem connected at first.
So walk me through the actual machinery here.
Yeah.
If an officer sends a highly biased, offensive meme and a private chat on a Tuesday, how does that specifically legally destroy an entirely unrelated narcotics arrest that same officer makes on a Friday?
Okay, to understand the mechanics, we have to look at how courts actually consume police work. A judge is almost never at the scene of the crime. The jury is not standing on the sidewalk during a traffic stop. The legal system evaluates police work entirely through narrative layers.
Meaning the sworn affidavits, the arrest reports, the use of force paperwork. The criminal justice system is essentially a massive machine built to process the officer's narrative.
Right. And that machine operates on a foundational assumption that the officer's narrative is truthful, neutral, and reliable.
Right, because if it's not, the whole thing falls apart.
Exactly. Before a case ever goes to a jury, it usually has to survive a suppression hearing. This is a pre-trial motion where the defense argues that the police violated the Constitution, maybe an illegal search of a car or a home, and therefore the evidence should be thrown out.
And the officer has to testify.
Right. The officer takes the stand and explains their legal justification. The judge's decision to keep or suppress the evidence rests almost entirely on whether they believe the officer's sworn testimony.
So what happens to that dynamic when a defense attorney acquires a leaked chat thread where that same officer is casually mocking the Constitution or using racial slurs?
The narrative layer just collapses.
Wow.
The American legal system operates under constitutional obligations known as Brady and Giglio.
I've heard those terms thrown around on TV shows, but what do they actually mean?
These rules mandate that prosecutors must turn over any evidence that could be favorable to the defense. That explicitly includes any material that impeaches the credibility of a state's witness.
Oh, I see.
So if an officer's digital footprint shows bias, a casual acceptance of rights violations, or a willingness to lie, the prosecutor is legally required to hand that chat log over to the defense attorney.
And the defense attorney takes that chat log straight to the suppression hearing. Hmm. They can cross-examine the officer and say, you know, you claim you pulled my client over on Friday because he rolled through a stop sign. But on Tuesday, you told your colleagues in this group chat that you target this specific demographic just to mess with them. Why should the judge believe your sworn narrative today?
Precisely. Once the defense introduces that doubt, the prosecution loses its evidentiary stability. The officer stops being the pillar supporting the case and becomes the central liability threatening to bring it down.
It's like the rebar failing.
Exactly. The analysis actually points to the Joseph Franco scandal in New York. Now, while that specific case involved fabricated observations rather than a group chat, the mechanical result is identical, a total credibility collapse.
Right.
When his ability to tell the truth became untenable, the district attorneys had to dismiss over 500 criminal cases. The narrative layer was just too corrupted to use.
Over 500 cases? That is insane. And the source also highlights a case in Toronto where chat material was leveraged to challenge officer credibility, causing a major downtown prosecution to completely disintegrate.
Yeah, and we also see this detailed by David Miller, a former federal prosecutor, regarding a scandal in Monmouth County, New Jersey. He articulated the exact mechanical threat. If an officer is the sole source of facts for a search warrant, and their credibility is shredded by a leaked text thread, the integrity of the entire judicial process is compromised.
So everything that officer touched becomes legally radioactive.
Yes. The defense doesn't even need to definitively prove the specific traffic stop was unlawful. They only need to prove the officer's reliability is so contested that the court cannot trust their narrative.
So individual cases collapsing in local courtrooms is obviously an absolute nightmare for a district attorney.
Yeah.
But the source material outlines how this danger scales up even further.
Oh, it gets much bigger.
Right. Because when these discriminatory texts surface inside an agency that receives federal funding, we aren't just talking about local suppression hearings anymore. The threat matrix shifts to the federal government.
And this is a critical misunderstanding by municipal leaders. Local agencies instinctively try to contain the damage. They label a leaked chat as an HR issue, a morale problem, or a breach of professionalism.
Keep it in-house.
Exactly. But if you are a federally funded agency and your officers are generating written records suggesting they police differently based on race, color, or national origin, you have crossed a massive legal threshold. You are now dealing with a Title VI violation.
Okay, let's define the mechanics of that. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits federally funded agencies from conducting their programs in a discriminatory manner.
So the federal government basically views this as a breach of contract.
Exactly. Furthermore, under the Safe Streets Act, the Department of Justice explicitly ties federal law enforcement funding to non-discriminatory public safety practices.
Wow. Okay.
So when a group chat leaks, it ceases to be a local personnel problem. The DOJ treats it as a systemic compliance failure. The situation in Antioch, California, serves as the perfect blueprint for this escalation. Right? In Antioch, racist and sexist text messages among officers emerged during a separate investigation. And it didn't just end with a few localized suspensions and some angry city council meetings.
Not at all. The DOJ launched a massive investigation under Title VI and the Safe Streets Act. The federal government does not view those texts as the isolated actions of a few immature employees.
No, they view the texts as hard documentary evidence that the department's federally funded programs are being administered with bias.
Yes. The presence of the group chat proves that the local supervisory structure is fundamentally broken.
To put the scale of this into perspective, it's like a local prosecutor dropping a single drug case because of a compromised officer. It's like a factory firing one worker on the assembly line who was slacking off.
Mm-hmm.
But a Title VI intervention by the DOJ is the equivalent of the federal government stepping in halting production, and recalling the entire assembly line because they have determined the factory machinery itself is fundamentally contaminated.
That is exactly what happens, and the remedies demanded under Title VI reflect that scale. The federal government does not issue a memo reminding officers to be polite. The remedy is structural reconstruction.
They tear it down to the studs.
Yeah. In Antioch, the federal intervention required the department to overhaul how they process citizen complaints. It mandated comprehensive, granular data collection on every single traffic stop and use of force incident to track demographic disparities.
That's huge.
It required outside review of internal affairs investigations and ongoing rigorous compliance reporting to federal monitors.
Because the existence of a sprawling, unchecked group chat proves that whatever internal alarms were supposed to go off failed completely.
Right.
Like if an entire squad is engaging in corrosive dark humor and coordinating in a shadow channel and no sergeant or lieutenant ever intervenes, the federal government just assumes your systems are failing at a programmatic level.
Exactly. So with the threat of federal oversight looming and local cases dissolving due to Brady and Giglio obligations, the obvious question for police departments is how to actually fix the architecture.
Because simply putting out a policy that says, hey, don't use private group chats, clearly isn't working.
No, not at all. Sanders argues that the answer is control, not just policy.
Right.
The shadow culture survives because it's highly adaptive. If a department bans WhatsApp, the officers just migrate to Signal. If Signal is banned, they move to standard private text threads.
So what's the fix?
The only viable solution is to stop treating this as a communication style issue and start treating it as a strict digital architecture issue. The department must own the real estate where the communication happens.
What does that look like mechanically for a police department? Like in practice?
It requires an absolute mandate. Zero personal mobile devices utilized for police work while on duty.
None.
None. If a communication relates to an arrest, a suspect, an operation, or a patrol sector, it must occur on a department-controlled, department-retained network.
Which means no officer installed encrypted apps on department-issued phones either.
Exactly. And to enforce that architecture, departments have to implement proactive mechanisms. You need periodic joint audits between the Information Technology Department and Internal Affairs.
Wait, how does that audit actually work without violating an officer's privacy? Are they just reading everyone's text messages all day?
They don't necessarily have to read the content to spot the shadow channel.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, IT can audit the municipal network using mobile device management profiles. They look for unauthorized application installations. They look for abnormal data transfer volumes on encrypted apps that shouldn't even be on the device in the first place.
So they're looking for the shape of the communication, not the words.
Precisely. They analyze metadata to see if a cluster of officers is communicating extensively on a secondary platform during their shift. The goal is to detect the architecture of a shadow channel before the content of that channel becomes a massive legal scandal.
And when allegation of a toxic group chat does arise, the response has to be immediate, right?
Immediate forensic preservation of the digital evidence. Securing the devices before data can be wiped and prompt notification to the local prosecutors so they can manage their Brady obligations.
Which makes sense.
Furthermore, the analysis stresses that simply reassigning an officer involved in these chats is not accountability.
Right.
Quietly moving a problematic officer from a narcotics unit to a patrol sector in a different neighborhood does not restore institutional integrity. It just redistributes the liability to a new zip code.
Which brings us to a really profound conclusion from the source material that changes the entire paradigm.
Mm.
The final defining question in any of these scandals is never, were the messages ugly?
No.
It's not, were the officers just venting stress? And it is certainly not, can the department's PR team outlast the negative news cycle? The final question is whether this specific command is fit to wield coercive state power.
Because police authority is utterly unique. It's not analogous to corporate authority.
No.
It is the literal power of the state to strip a citizen of their liberty, their physical safety, and their reputation.
So if the internal moral life of a police unit, as documented in their private texts, is completely detached from the constitutional obligations of their job, they are mechanically unfit to exercise that power.
The broader implication here is that public trust in law enforcement is not just a sentimental metric. Trust is the operational capital of the justice system. It is the currency that allows the machinery to function.
Wow, yeah.
If a community fundamentally distrusts the police because of these leaked communications, witnesses stop cooperating. Juries refuse to believe sworn testimony. Prosecutors cannot build viable cases. When credibility evaporates, the entire apparatus of the justice system grinds to a halt.
Which means you, listening right now, have a completely new framework for understanding this issue. The next time a news alert pops up about a leaked police group chat, you weren't going to look at the rubble and think, wow, those are some bad apples causing a PR crisis.
You're going to look straight at the rebar.
Exactly. You will recognize it as an evidentiary disaster. You will see the Brady and Giglio obligations kicking in. You will see the Title VI federal exposure looming. And you will understand exactly how the narrative layers of the court system are collapsing.
You'll understand the hidden mechanics of the law.
But I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over.
Okay.
We've established that the mechanical solution is migrating all police communications back onto strictly audited department-issued devices. We need total control of the digital architecture.
Right.
But what happens when real-time artificial intelligence and automated sentiment analysis are integrated into those official channels?
Oh, wow.
Right. Corporate IT departments already deploy algorithms that flag toxic behavior or harassment in company emails the moment they're sent. Could a police department system soon be trained to automatically flag corrosive dark humor, racial bias, or constitutional contempt on a patrol car's terminal before the officer even initiates a traffic stop?
That's a fascinating question.
And if a machine is constantly monitoring the moral weather of a police department in real time, what does that mean for the future of how the state surveils its own enforcers?
It changes everything.
Instead of waiting for the building to collapse to examine the rust, what if the rebar itself could send an alert the moment the structural integrity begins to fail? Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.